Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Tonight, we're talking about rethinking the psychiatric care system in the United States. And we have three guests joining us. Our first guest is Robert Whitaker. He's a science journalist and the author of several books, including two on the history of psychiatry. His newest book is Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. Laura Delano is an editor, a consultant, and a film festival organizer at MaddenAmerica.com. They have a big film festival coming up in Arlington next weekend at the Regent Theater. And we also have in the studio Dr. Mark Green. He's certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology in both general psychiatry and addiction psychiatry, and is an expert in psychopharmacology. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for coming.
Hi. Nice.
So first, I wanted to address the first question to Robert. Robert, how did this whole Madden America come to be?
Well, it actually goes back to a book I wrote in 2002 with that title called Mad in America. And that book really got its start to investigate this puzzle. The World Health Organization had twice done studies of schizophrenia outcomes in six developed countries, the U.S. and five other rich countries, compared to outcomes in three, quote, developing countries, poor countries, and that was India, Nigeria, and Colombia. And each time they found that outcomes were much better in the poor countries at the end of 2 and 5 years. And they actually concluded, the World Health Organization, that living in a developed country is, quote, a strong predictor, if you're diagnosed with schizophrenia, that you won't have a good outcome. So I wanted to know is, why would living in a developed country be a predictor that you'll do poorly? Because you think about, you know, our great medicine in the Western countries. My understanding is we were making great progress in treating schizophrenia with new medications, et cetera. So I wrote that first book to investigate that failure. And then in this last book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, I sort of broadened the scope. And if you look over the past 30 years, more and more people are getting diagnosed, more and more people are getting treated. And usually if you have, quote, diseases where more people are getting treated, you'll see the burden of that disease go down in society, right? Instead, what you see is the burden of mental illness in our society is going up and up and up. And one of the measures of that is the number of people on disability due to mental illness, in other words, receiving a government pension. So, for example, in 1987, there were 1.25 million adults in the United States receiving disability payment because of mental illness. We're now closing in on 5 million people.
Wow.
So there's this fourfold increase. And it raises the question whether this drug-centered paradigm of care we have, is it really serving our society well? And after Anatomy, I basically turned over this personal website I had, MaddenAmerica.com, and turned it into a webzine. And we now have about 150 people writing for it, and we carry news. And it's really meant to be a forum for rethinking psychiatry.
So one of the stories you've had on MaddenAmerica.com is Laura Delano's story. That's where I first read it. And Laura, I'd like you to kind of tell us your story about how you've come to the place you have. And you also have a website. What's the name of it?
RecoveringFromPsychiatry.com.
So could you tell us a little about your story, please?
Sure. So I spent about 14 years in the mental health system. I entered it as a 13-year-old. I was given a bipolar diagnosis as a 14-year-old, and I exited it as a 27-year-old. And I look back now and see that I think what really got me labeled bipolar as a young teenager was I had intense anger. I was really depressed. I was confused. I was struggling. I was, you know, I had it together at school, but I'd come home and I'd explode and rage. And my parents did what all good parents, loving parents, are taught to do in our society. They knew I needed help, and they sent me to a therapist, and the therapist did what she could, but eventually said, I think Laura's, you know, she has some serious stuff going on. So I was sent to a psychiatrist, and I was told that my anger and my rage was a symptom of mania, and that I had juvenile bipolar disorder, and I was immediately put on Depakote and Prozac. And that was the beginning of my journey into the system. And it took me a long time to get out. And to sum up what was a very long and complicated story, basically, you know, I really ended up coming to believe deeply in this notion that my suffering and the struggles that I had were caused by a biochemical imbalance in my brain. That was what I was told. You know, doctor after doctor at top hospitals said, you know, you have lifelong brain disease and you need medication, just like people with diabetes need insulin. And I really bought into that because I was suffering and I wanted an answer and I wanted a solution. And year after year went on and I just kept falling further and further apart, all along believing this was my quote unquote treatment resistant mental illness, which is what I was told. And one med became two medications, became three, became four, became five. And in 2010, I was on five drugs, unable to work, going to day treatment at a local hospital every day. And I happened upon Anatomy of an Epidemic, this book that Bob has written. And it was a really profound aha moment for me. It basically was the first time I was presented an alternative narrative for what I was going through. And in a pretty short matter of time, I decided to leave the system. I came off of all the drugs. I was tapered off very quickly, and it's in general and very important to taper very, very slowly, especially if you've been on psychiatric drugs for a long time. But that was all in 2010. And since then, I've basically spent the last 4 years kind of discovering myself for the first time in this unmedicated life. And I've left behind the psychiatric labels that I was given. I no longer think of myself as having a mental illness, and I deeply identified with those labels for a long time. And I found my own human, you know, an alternative way to make sense of everything I went through that is apart from the conventional medical model of psychiatry.
That's a nice summation. I've heard the longer version in my life, and wow, that was great. But I mean, so how did you get the courage to change, and what did you put in place to just stop everything and get off the cycle?
That's such a good question. I mean, making the decision to leave my relationship with the mental health system was the scariest, most difficult thing I ever did in my life. Because I really had come to rely on my diagnosis as a framework for making sense of who I was. I'd come to rely on these pills, even though they never actually helped, and I kept getting more and more dysfunctional in my life. I relied so deeply on the pills. So deciding to transform my relationship to all of that was incredibly scary. And I think there were a lot of factors that played a role in my successful departure. I think hands down, one of the biggest was just the support that I had from family and friends. At the time, I was active in a 12-step program that was very supportive as well. I think I needed people to be present with me to not suggest that I go back on medications, even though I was struggling. I just needed people to be present with me while I made sense of everything myself, because I basically had to reconstruct an entirely new narrative to make sense of my life.
Right.
Yeah, it was very confusing.
Dr. Mark Green, welcome to Right Turn Radio. Welcome back to Right Turn Radio.
Thank you very much.
Is this a common story? Have you heard this before?
Oh, yeah. It's a tragically common story. But I've heard a lot more stories like this over the last few years because, you know, I'd say in the last 10 years, the voices of people like Laura and people in recovery has taught me a lot more than my reading of psychiatric journals. Mm. I'd say that, you know, when you're trained in psychiatry, you're trained in a psychiatric paradigm, right? And sort of discourse. And through the 80s and 90s, it was all about, you know, taking medications and the biological illness. And there were all these violations of the rule where people weren't doing better. Mm. Right. But you keep struggling around to fit a biological reason and rationale for that. Over the last 10 years, there's been more and more people like Laura coming out saying, this isn't working for me. And I think that Bob's book really synthesized a great deal of those voices and arguments to generate a lot of change. So we do hear more and more people who are not getting better with psychiatric medications and are looking for other forms of recovery and treatment, and doing a hell of a lot better once they come off their medications.
What can we learn before we go to the break briefly of from patients like Laura, from people who have kind of, I don't know if it's a misdiagnosis or mistreatment. Is there a lesson for the folks in your line of work?
I think I'd love to hear more from Laura about, in answer to Abby's questions, about what she put in place to enable this to take her life into a new direction. I think Laura got diagnosed with juvenile bipolar disorder while that was really all the rage.
Still a bit of the rage,
but I hope that there's more questioning, certainly around this area. And I think partly because of Bob's work.
And that's, you know, learning more about diagnosing, getting more involved as the families get involved, especially of juveniles, and making sure that people are dynamic in the situation of diagnosis and treatment seems to be a big theme here. We're going to go to a break. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. Guests in the studio are Bob Whitaker. He's a science journalist and the author of several books, including Mad in America. Laura Delano is here as well. She's an editor and a consultant and the organizer of the Mad in America Film Festival on October 9th through 12th at the Arlington Regent Theater. And Dr. Mark Green, he's a certified psychiatrist, certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, and he practices in Belmont, Massachusetts.
So I just had a question, because my hackles always get raised when people, I'm just worried that everybody's going to think they should come off their meds. It's all a conspiracy. It's all that. But Bob, you've done a lot of research, and what does research show?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, no one should take anything they hear on this radio as a advice to do anything personally. I think that's really important to know.
This is trends.
Yes. And what you did hear a story. What you're really hearing, you heard a personal story that is out of the normal narrative of you have to take the medications for life. You heard a psychiatrist saying, you know, we're changing our thinking about what we know. So that's part of it. Here's the thing. We understand, or we're led to understand, say that everyone needs to, it really a one-size-fits-all. You need to take these medications for life because they fix a known chemical imbalance. Well, first of all, if you look at that, it's not true. We just don't know what the etiology of these mental disorders are. But more importantly, what are long-term studies telling us about the effect of medications, say, on the course of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, you find, surprisingly, you don't find evidence that you're improving outcomes in the aggregate. So, for example, the best long-running study that we have is schizophrenia outcomes. This was done by Martin Harrow at the University of Illinois. It was those who got off medication early on had a much higher recovery rate. They were much more likely to be working 5, 10, 15 years later. They were much more likely to not be symptomatic. And what that tells you is that, at the very least, this idea that one size fits all with the medications, it's just not born in the literature, in the science. That's not what's telling us.
So, but what you're also, I mean, in that case, maybe even the healthier people got off, but they shouldn't have been on.
Well, really,
anymore.
Yeah. What you're really seeing in that study is that there are some people do better off. That's one thing, and that two, there is this strain in the literature. Are the medications doing something to the brain that actually make mental disorders run a more chronic course generally? But I want to say one thing. If you look at the where you're seeing the best long-term outcomes in the Western world today, it's in northern Finland. And there they use medications in a selective manner along really three principles. Some people, they never put on antipsychotics. Sometimes they have another group, they use them temporarily, and then they have a third group that they use them continuously. So what you see there in this place that has figured this out is a protocol that really tries to figure out for whom and for how long, which is so different from take your drugs forever, which is the message she got.
But I'm sorry, is our system geared towards that kind of dynamic review of somebody's case?
Well, I would say then, no, it's not geared to that, but why can't we make it geared to that?
So we have all the answers.
Mark, could you answer for all of psychiatry, please?
I'll do my best. There we go. So, you know, Bob raises important points, and a lot of discussion goes on triggered by what he says. So these issues of whether diseases are going up and the burden of disease is going up, and they are, you know, but they are for kidney disease and heart disease and psychiatric disease too. You know, you don't want to, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say that all of, you know, heart disease treatment is rubbish, and, you know, because the burden of disease is going up. Now, Bob doesn't say all of psychiatric treatment is rubbish, but but a lot of people who might listen to you might sort of extrapolate, I think. And, you know, when there's the issue of, like, the longitudinal studies like Harrow, there's also been this debate about how much is correlative versus causative.
Right.
So is it that the people who do better come off medications quicker and stay off medications quicker? But he also rightly brings up the issue that there's some important studies which try to control and contrast. And there is a suggestion that maybe intermittent dosing or keeping the doses low might be the best approach and for many people. And that one size doesn't fit all. So there are some people who need to be regularly reviewed, do better when they come off medications, and you know, so it's a very complicated field. The difficulty is that psychiatry has been too one-fit-all, and there is, you know, the majority of people out there in America get very scarce treatment by underqualified people seeing way too many people with no resources.
Right.
In certain, in India or in some of the WHO studies, you know, in northern Finland, there's a more community-based approach. There's more embedding of treatment in the community where there's work and there's family and there's community support, and that seems to be incredibly important. Actually, Laura's story brought that up with the involvement of 12-step fellowship, you know, and the importance of people in her life, and that underfinanced resource in this country.
So how do you get good? How do you find out what good help is, and how would you decide? And if, you know, from your research, Bob, how about you? Actually, that probably makes the most sense.
Well, for me, the thing is this, is we believe in evidence-based medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think psychiatry really has been practicing real evidence-based medicine when they have this one-size-fits-all. And there is a new discussion around that if we bring in the long-term outcomes, we really have to rethink the place of medications in a larger form of holistic psychiatric care.
Right.
And that's really what's changing. And I honestly believe that, you know, Harrell's even writing new stuff, but there's other studies of this, that if we really look at the scientific literature, it's telling us to rethink the use of medications in a pretty profound way. Because you go on the medications, it does change the brain, which makes it very difficult to come off, as Laura talked about. And we're just not, to be honest with you, the long-term outcomes are just not that good. And which tells you, can we use these medications as a tool, as a part of a larger approach in a sort of selective, cautious manner, and talk about some of the holistic things, and I think we could get much better outcomes. But I think science is telling us, rethink our use of these drugs.
And maybe suggesting that there are some people who 10 years ago you'd automatically put on medications, who you can think about differently now and think, maybe let's try and avoid medications or use very sparingly and use other approaches.
Oh.
Well, I was just, you know, we see anecdotally at our clinic people come in who have been on, an SSRI that was prescribed to them at 14 by their PCP, and they've been on it for 10 years, and you know, during which there's been, you know, episodes of active drug use and all that, and there seems to be a little bit of a loose hand among the medical community, not the psychiatric community, but often people are like, we talked about the story of somebody walking in and 20 minutes later walking out with a diagnosis of bipolar 2. Is there a way to tighten that up? I'm just wondering, Abby, you know this, that we've often seen the, you know, these people come in with a bundle of diagnoses.
Kind of proud of them a little sometimes too.
Yeah, very. And like Laura like talked about, identity. It's like it becomes something you talk about, and it becomes part of the way you view yourself in the world.
You also need a diagnosis sometimes
absolutely.
To get certain benefits.
Right, which is a whole nother thing. So when we come back, I'd like to discuss, if we could, some of the roles that the insurance world plays in this and the pharmaceutical companies play in the treatment of mental health issues in the United States. It's a small topic, Abby.
Yeah.
Probably cover it in another 5 minutes, we'll be done.
But they seem to be bringing up this radical idea that maybe the patients have something to say in this, and that talking to patients is who they know a lot about what they're going through. So how did we get here? So Laura, you were saying during the break, you were talking about how you made the decision to get out, to stop, and how it was accepted by your treatment team. Except it's not the right word.
Yes. Well, so this all, my big shift happened back in 2010, and it started with just a few kind of quiet questions in the back of my mind, really around my identity. Who am I on these drugs? Who would I be off of these drugs? Those questions started to creep in because I'd been on them since I was a child, and I had no idea who I was off of them. And the questions totally scared me too. So I was trying to push them down and ignore them, but they were at the back of my mind. And I eventually ended up finding Bob's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, completely by accident. And I read it, and it's a bit of a miracle that I actually read it, because I was very heavily medicated and reading was difficult at that time. But it really spoke to me. And looking at what the data shows on long-term use of psychiatric drugs, it really just all of a sudden I had this new clarity on the previous, basically, over, well over a decade of my life that had just kind of continuously fallen further and further apart the deeper into the mental health system I got. And it just all of a sudden was, holy cow, what if I haven't been sick all along? What if my treatment has been making me sick?
Were you talking to your treatment team about these concerns?
At first I wasn't, and then I started to raise these questions. I did eventually ask to come off of the drugs.
What was their reaction?
It was no. But I kept asking. And I think as I basically, one of, the main, what I think was so important for me to do at that time was to start to educate myself so that I could build a voice. And so that because I had forgotten that I had a voice. I'd forgotten that I owned my body. I owned my mind. I should be the only agent in my life. And here I am, this totally compliant, passive, dependent patient. That was who I was. And slowly but surely, I realized, wait a minute, I have a right to make decisions for myself. I have a right to say no. And so I started to educate myself on the science. I started to read about the DSM. I started to really just build myself a new narrative, and I started to speak louder and louder. And eventually my treatment team, I think, realized that I wasn't going to listen to them, and they ended up agreeing to taper me off of most of the drugs I was on. But really, I didn't actually use them as much of much. They didn't play much of a role in my withdrawal experience, other than writing the prescriptions and doing the actual tapering. I really got my emotional support outside of the conventional system. And it was, the process for me of leaving behind the mental health system was the process of me reclaiming my identity and my agency.
That's a pretty incredible story. Well, I mean, just the presence of mind it takes to get there and to follow through with that. And you talked about the support you had from your family and from the community and all that. I'm wondering, we talked about before the break the way that the possibility that there might be some of this might be driven by the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. And Bob, I just wanted to ask you, what you have found about that influence.
You can't discuss psychiatric care in this country and what we believe about it without discussing the pharmaceutical industry and actually also the alliance they made, especially in the 1990s, with psychiatrists at academic medical schools. And really what happened was this, in a nutshell. In 1980, the American Psychiatric Association published the third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And in that manual, they said, they just made a decision, we are going to start considering these things as diseases of the brain, and whatever you have, these will be symptoms. Now, once you have that model, that's an infectious disease model in essence. Mm-hmm. And then what you want to do is have drugs that knock down the symptoms, and if they're a little better than placebo over the short term, that becomes an effective agent. And so once that happens, once the APA decides to adopt this model, the pharmaceutical company loves this, right? Because this is like, it so
targeted
fits into
marketing.
The selling of drugs.
We've got something for that. Mother
and
then, issues, nope.
No. And then what really happened beginning in the 1980s is pharmaceutical companies began hiring psychiatrists at the best academic medical schools across the country to serve as speakers, consultants, advisors. So you got this alliance in storytelling, and there was a lot of money basically behind a story that said, listen, we know these things are diseases of the brain. They're under-recognized and under-treated, so let's get more and more people treated. The drugs are like insulin for diabetes. Now, that's a false story. It's just not true. And so really, how did we get here? We got here because in 1980, the APA adopted a certain model, and then money promoted that model. And something like 87% of Americans now know that depression is caused by low serotonin. But it's not true. Mm. And that tells us one of our big problems is that, frankly, sort of a delusion has been fostered. In other words, we think the medications do something that they don't. But that's how we got here. It is a story of commerce. And by the way, a very successful story of commerce.
Yes.
One in five American adults now takes a psychiatric drug on a daily basis, which is, just from a business point of view, fantastic success.
Yeah, I'm in the wrong business. Laura, you shared your story. Bob, you kind of gave insight onto how we got here. But Mark, I'm wondering what you see as you know, psychiatry's role in this world, and what does psychiatry do well in your opinion?
Well, look, I mean, I think that Bob and Laura's perspectives are so important. So Bob's got a whole historical.
That's funny. Hey, they call that a Freudian slip.
That's so funny. No. He's got an amazing historical perspective, and he's got a lot of science knowledge. If I wanted to speak for the psychiatry profession, what do we do well? You know, I do think that there's something of value about looking at clusters of signs and symptoms as diseases. It's imprecise. It has fed. It gave the pharmaceutical company something to jump onto. But it has helped us develop some kind of treatment approaches and be able to test them against something. You're always looking at anything in the world through a certain lens. The lens has been far too focused upon biological perspectives, and that is, I'm very glad to say, softening now, in part because the neuroscience too has caught up with the fact that development and trauma and early life experiences and ongoing life experiences and nurturance and support and family all impact the way the brain works, right? So it's not it's a more complex model now, which needs to embrace more complex approaches to treatment. I think psychiatry has broadened and are learning these things, but there is a historical period of intense biological focus which caused a lot of people a lot of distress. People like Laura and so many others, were told that they were diseased, told their brain was malfunctioning, and that these meds were going to fix it, using a very imprecise and harmful model of simplistic and financially backed rationale, which we were all taught in medical school and residencies. So I'm glad that psychiatry is maturing, and I'm glad for Laura's and Bob's nudging of it to get a move on.
Yeah, and it seems like you guys said we need a lot of different voices in this discussion, because it feels to me like you guys are all on the same page. You want better care, and you know, for people that suffer from this stuff, and you want you know, kind of a wider reaching way of dealing with it instead of just throwing these tools at, you know, it's money in the bank in a lot of ways, you know, that you can throw this stuff in it. It's a great discussion. We're going to be back in a minute. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We're continuing our conversation about rethinking psychiatric care in the United States. Man, this is a big one.
Yeah, so we can sum it all up in the next segment.
Let's fix it now.
That's right. Well, Bob and Mark, both of you, you know, where do we go from here? What is the role for medications, and what other things need to be, you know, looked at?
Well, let me just say, so my feeling and what I've sort of, you know, why Mad in America now exists as a webzine is I think more and more people, and you heard it with Mark's comments and Laura's comments, are saying we really do need to rethink about how we help people the best, and how our society, what sort of systems of care we should set up, and even how we should conceive of things. And my own belief is you need a big-bodied societal discussion about that. You need psychiatrists involved, psychologists, family members, and people with lived experience. And then you need a forum where they can exchange ideas and learn from each other, and also look at programs here in the U.S. and abroad that are getting very good results, and then hopefully we can copy from them. And so that's what my sense is, where we're at now. How do we as a society rethink things? And there's no one group that has the answer. And that's what we're trying to promote at Mad in America, is this multi-bodied, you know, multi-voice discussion. And we'll talk about this, but that's one of the reasons we have this film festival coming out. We have filmmakers with 30 films. We have panels. And the whole point is you're going to see in those films different perceptions of what's right, what's wrong, subjective experiences. You're going to see people from Iceland. And I think the point of this is if we begin with the sense that we've had one form of care, now we want to develop a new form of care, you need a lot of voices, and we can learn from each other, and with the sense of goodwill towards everybody. That's the sense of it. And Mark can talk about the need for medications.
Yeah, so we can talk about the need for medications have been very important, right? So so OCD, you know, got medications for OCD can be incredibly helpful.
Right.
Medications for emotional distress during height of psychosis can be very important. Sedatives during deep anxiety and antidepressants, they all have a role. The difference between placebo might be small, but it's the case for psychotherapies too. When you measure psychotherapy treatment, they also don't do tremendously well. You know, we're, you know, science and, you know, moves incrementally, and you try to pick out what helps a little, but you also start unpacking the question and realizing that they're a lot more complicated than you originally thought. So I think that there are roles for medications. They're probably more targeted, and it's not a one fits all. I see medications as being facilitative of a change process, which focuses around really listening to the patient, you know, really trying to help them establish a new narrative. And, you know, what came across in Laura's story was this formation of a new identity, her growing agency and autonomy. These are things which we know in general psychotherapy are incredibly important in substance use treatment. That's what we're going for in motivational interviewing a lot of the time. You know, so it's the emergence of a new identity, which is crucial. But medication certainly can play a very helpful role in all of that.
I know oh, Mark. Well. I used to work with Mark, and I know that there's not many better that do what you do, and you evolve, and you work with the client to really create a treatment plan.
Thanks,
so
man.
And that's what the way it should be.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we work with the clients to make a treatment plan. Now, that wasn't something that Laura has to force that on her treatment team. And really, it sounds like you left the treatment team because they weren't playing ball. You had to go outside of the psychiatric profession to find help. Now there's a bit more help around because there's people like you who are talking and advising, but it shouldn't be that way. It should be a collaborative process. And a friend of mine, Chris Gordon, who at Advocates is developing, doing research to try to see what factors of collaborative care are most effective. Many people are Pat Deegan, and a lot of folks are really trying to figure that out. It needs to shift to a more collaborative approach. And psychiatry knew this before DSM-3. Before they said this is a disease, people worked listening to people's narratives, helping them with their identity. And there's been a return to those kind of more listening approaches.
So, Laura, what do you do to take care of yourself now?
Well, that's a big question. I think the most important piece for me was this shift in consciousness that's happened for me. For me, leaving behind the medical model, this disease model, was absolutely critical because when I viewed my suffering and my insomnia and my racing thoughts and all of those things as quote-unquote symptoms of a quote-unquote disease, that essentially stripped away my agency. I'm sick. This isn't my fault. This is something that's happening to me because of my biology. And that just the sense of helplessness and powerlessness for me in holding on to that model, I needed to let go of that for myself in order to actually change who I was. And so that's been the most important piece of it all, has been the shift in the way I make sense of what I've gone through. There's so many things today, but I think getting off, my personal experience of coming off psychiatric drugs was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. Mm. For the first year and a half off of the drugs, every day was a battle.
Yeah.
It took a really long time for my brain to heal from the trauma of these drugs. It was confusing and complicated, and all along the way I wondered, is this an underlying condition coming out? Is this withdrawal? I needed to give myself a lot of time. I needed to be patient. I'm 4 years in now, and I've healed tremendously, but it's been a long road. And I'd say things like, nutrition, exercise, mm-hmm. finding my own sense of meaning in my life and purpose has been critical. Having support of friends, but for me, what really has been essential has been leaving behind that medical model of how I make sense of my struggles.
It's kind of an amazing journey. We're on our way out, so I want to make sure we get in information about the film festival next weekend. Could you tell us real quickly?
I just want to say one thing. Laura is the one who organized the whole film festival.
Oh, good,
and has been working about 60 hours per week. So it just shows us, we're so proud of
this. What's the website?
The film festival website is madinamericainternationalfilmfestival.com.
Okay, and it's at the Regent Theater in Arlington, Massachusetts, October 9th through the 12th. Go on their website to check that out. You can also find more out about Mad in America on madinamerica.com. You can get more about Laura in recovering from psychiatry. .com, and you can find out more about Mark Green and Psych Garden in Belmont.
Yeah, psychgarden.com.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.